Hi, this is Justin Landa with Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am joined by Sam Sykes. Sam is the author of the Aeon's Gate trilogy and a forthcoming novel from Orbit Books and Gallants titled A City Stained Red. He's been nominated for the British Fantasy Award for his short fiction and maintains the second most bizarre Twitter feed among genre authors. It's also been reported widely that his jawline is magnificent. Welcome, Sam.
Hey, what's the title of the podcast called?
Rocket Talk.
Rocket Talk?
Yeah, Rocket Talk. Because the Tor.com's mascot is Stubby the Rocket, if you're not familiar.
It's Stubby the Rocket, huh?
Yeah, his name is Stubby. I had several suggestions for a title. I was going for Stubby Soapbox, but we thought Stubby's, that sounded a little creepy.
Like this also sounds kind of creepy. Rocket Talk?
Rocket Talk, a little creepy for you?
Rocket Talk, just a couple of guys talking rockets.
When you put it that way, it's a little creepy.
Just a couple of guys talking about their stubby rockets.
Yeah, have you ever seen that skit on Saturday Night Live? It's like Coffee Talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of going for that, only with rockets.
With rockets.
Uh-huh.
I don't know much about rockets.
Yeah.
Like, one went to the moon?
I mean, kind of. I mean, the rocket propelled.
Rocket was involved.
Yeah, it's what broke the atmosphere, I think, okay. Is the technical term.
Okay.
I don't work for NASA, but I think that's how it works. I just saw that Elon Musk, which is by far the best billionaire name ever, right? Musk.
Musk.
Yeah. I wonder what his musk smells like, but Elon
Musk. I bet maybe that's how he got to be a billionaire, by selling his musk.
On PayPal.
On PayPal.
But yeah, they just launched a rocket that's going to be like the great rocket that's going to revolutionize private space flight.
Like just by launching it, it's revolutionized it?
Well, if the launching is successful and cost effective, I think.
God.
I'm not really up to speed on the economies of scale of rockets, despite the title of the podcast.
That is a really great idea, because we are living in the age where nerds are becoming more and more powerful. And they are getting a lot of money, and they will pay for really strange things. Like Richard Garriott.
I don't know who that is.
He made Ultima Online,
right. The
Ultima series, and he paid to go into space. So soon you will have like very powerful nerds who create like the next form of social media and sell it for $1 million.
Do you think George R. R. Martin would like to go to space?
What I hear is that he is buying up all the houses on his street.
Fascinating.
Like with the idea that he's going to rename that street, but I think he's probably not going to stop there. He's just going to keep, he wants a kingdom.
Do you think he wants to buy like all of Santa Fe?
I think that's where he'll start.
Interesting. And he already owns a movie theater, right?
Yeah, he does. It's a really nice theater. I was at the event for Dangerous Women there, and it was a lot of fun.
Would you call it opulent?
I would call it opulent. Well, you know, like intimately opulent.
Is there guilt? Not guilt, like
there's a lot of guilt. It is actually built on some mass graves.
I don't mean like guilt in the biblical sense. I mean like does it have golden filigree?
Is there guilt? I don't remember. Okay. I remember there was like a shrine to him in like of his books, and I know they've sold a lot, but I'm like, where does it end? Like, when he buys up houses, do you think maybe it's like North Korean style, where every house must have a picture of George R. R. Martin in the living room, and you can't take it down?
I'd like to think so, or like maybe just a pair of suspenders in every closet.
Every man must wear the fisherman hat.
Primary elections are in full swing. Do you think there's a George R. R. Martin lobby in New Mexico, perhaps to allow him to rename Santa Fe Westeros?
I mean, maybe.
It's possible.
It's possible. I don't know if he has that ambition. I'll ask him next time I see him, or we can ask Ty Frank. And yeah, we'll get to the bottom of this.
There does seem to be a very strong nascent fantasy writer, science fiction writer crew in New Mexico, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Have you considered relocating?
No. New Mexico is very cold.
Is it?
And, yeah, it's pretty chilly. Well, Santa Fe is. It's well, up
the
in the
base of the Rockies, right?
Yeah, the base of the Rockies and
kind of the ass end of the Rockies.
Yeah, and it's like like Santa Fe, because we go there every Christmas. There's just not a lot to do. Like, you can go downtown, and there's this guy that sells fajitas, and he's great, but, like, that's a lot to base a life on.
I enjoy fajitas. It's actually one of the biggest attractions of moving to South Texas.
Like, he has, like, three kinds of fajitas, so you could
would
ask...
Would you call those kinds beef, chicken, and seafood?
Seafood fajitas? Wow.
Like shrimp fajitas?
They do live ostentatiously in South Texas.
Yeah, well, they're not real big on the shrimp fajitas here, but they were pretty big on the East Coast, where nobody knows what Mexican food is.
Well, yeah, they don't. I had chili in New York once, and it was like beef in tomato soup.
Yeah, no, I've actually learned here in Chile, you know, chili in Texas, there's like Texas chili, which apparently does not have beans. Are you familiar with this?
I mean, that sounds legit. I can't imagine. Like, Texans probably don't care that much for beans. Like, very weak.
It's more like Sloppy Joe mix, but spicier. And
that's not bad.
I mean, it's not awful, but I like a good kidney bean.
I like beans. They are the good... We're supposed to be talking about, like, genre. Like, this is what we're supposed to be talking about is...
We'll get there, Sam.
I'm just saying.
So if we were going to segue, we were talking about beans, which is like a magical fruit. So I hear. And as we say, magic is genre-y.
That's pretty genre-y. Magic is less popular now, but it's still there.
Okay, so that's a good. Thank you for that segue, Sam. It was almost good. Professional radio segue.
Nice.
So let's talk about you a little bit.
About me.
Yeah, how are you? Things are well in your career?
Yeah, things are doing okay. Working hard on the second book. About to segue into some ape fights.
Did you have a title for the second book yet?
Yeah, it's The Mortal Tally.
The Mortal Tally.
Yes.
I'm really bummed you couldn't fit an N in there, because you could have been TMNT.
Yeah. TMNT, the Ninja Mortal Tally?
Yes. For those who don't know, TMNT is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, the Mortal Ninja Tally. Yeah, sorry, everybody.
Way to fuck it up, Sam.
Yeah, we could have. Whoa. You are representing Tor here.
I'm going to have to edit that out.
you are representing Stubby the Rocket. If he could see you now.
He would shake his head, even though he doesn't have a neck.
He would be a little stubbier.
He would be stubbier with rage.
Yeah.
So we're talking about your second book that you're working on in this new series. A lot of people probably don't know about the next one, which is called A City Stained Red. And you've changed U.S. publishers for that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We are now with Orbit and not with Pyre.
Orbit is the publisher of some of your favorite writers. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Orbit publishes Brent Weeks, who, you know, I'm sure he's got like maybe a few fans out there.
He's doing okay. Last I checked.
He's doing okay. He still sometimes hits me up for money, but
I actually think a lot of people don't maybe quite realize how big a deal Brent Weeks is.
Like, maybe they should come be at a con with him, like I was.
He's a big deal. And see him,
like, he puts a paper crown on his head, and he just pointed out over the audience and settled on two people and said, "You and you, kiss." And they did. They just kissed right there.
To say what you will about Brent Weeks, but he's a lover.
He's a lover, and then he made them fight.
He made them fight to the death.
Yeah, Orbit does Brent Weeks and Kay Jemison and Brian McClellan.
It's McClellan?
I like McLellan. it makes him sound like a magic sword or something.
He's a lovely fellow.
He's a lovely fellow, and he writes a very good book that I gave a blurb to because I liked it so much.
Yeah, and it is very good, and he's got his third book coming out here pretty soon.
I know.
He's cranking them out, right?
It's a goddamn machine.
Yeah.
He's got like a billion novellas and like...
And also publishes Joe Abercrombie, who you also enjoy.
I like Joe. He's got a good head on his shoulder, and I think
nice looking head.
I think he's pretty handsome, that guy, and he knows it. And you know, he probably looks at himself in the mirror a lot, and like he looks at himself and goes, "You know what? That's all right."
And he has a great author photo where he kind of does like the hands,
yeah,
leaning into one another.
His wife is a professional photographer, so he's
like
got
cheating.
That. Yeah, it is cheating. He should have to pay her. And maybe he did.
He probably did. It's probably a shell game.
Probably.
Tax write-off.
I think it's a bum rap that Joe gets sort of credited with Grimdark, because I don't think he's very Grimdark.
Wow, Sam, I would almost say that you're hunting for an opportunity to talk about Grimdark.
I mean, not really, because every time I do, someone jumps on me. It's like, well, tell me what Grimdark means. And I'm like, well, this is what I think it means. Like, well, does everyone think it means that? I'm like, I guess not.
That is really the problem with Grimdark, right? It's like,
yeah.
You know, you have the people that like to use it as a pejorative. You have the people who use it as a subgenre classification akin to high fantasy.
Yeah.
And then you have the people who use it to mean something that it is definitely not, which they use it to mean like dark fantasy.
Right.
Which clearly that's an entirely different thing.
Yeah, I think so.
So I do think that's the biggest problem. It's a term in want of a definition or in search of a definition.
I mean, I guess I could be guilty of having used it as a pejorative. To me, it's just like darkness that is kind of ridiculous.
Do you think are there any grimdark titles, again, under a definition of grimdark that will remain vague, but is there anything out there that you would consider grimdark that you think is, I don't want to say worthwhile, but that you seek out to read?
I mean, I definitely hold on to, I just spent a time saying he's not grimdark, but, you know, Joe definitely is one of my favorite darker fantasy writers. And, you know, you know, using grimdark as the definition that I use it as, like, as something that is kind of ridiculous and...
You use it as a term of avoidance, right? Like, when you label something as grimdark, it means you are avoiding it.
I try not to, because a lot of the titles that I consider grimdark are hugely popular. And I'm not about to, you know, I don't want to tell people like, oh, you like Grimdark, so ergo you are foolish for liking this. I want to say Grimdark to me is just like, it's not for me, but I can see why it would be for someone.
Well, I think what we have to be careful of is we'll use Mark Lawrence as an example. You know, Mark's a great writer.
An amazing writer, and he deserves all the success he's gotten, which has been considerable.
So regardless of whether you enjoy the novels or not, saying that you don't enjoy them is in no way, in my opinion, a criticism of the work.
Absolutely not.
It's just a criticism of...
I think it's an appraisal.
Sure.
I think it is just me saying, like, all right, this guy is... very popular. He clearly knows what he's doing. He's got a confident voice, but you know, it's not for me. I am of a generation that played a lot of violent video games. It, you know, I am kind of desensitized to the point where like it just doesn't do much for me anymore.
If folks, you know, and everybody's looking for different things when they read, but you know, some of us are looking for something that's that captures us in a certain way. And I think there's a transportive, is that a word?
I think you're like trying very hard not to use the word escapist.
Yes, I am sort of trying to avoid using that word.
Oh shit, I just called you out.
It's not really the word I'm looking for.
Right.
Because again, that's a word that tends to have a negative connotation, even when we don't necessarily mean it that way. But, you know, a lot of us kind of want to kind of read for a sense of getting away from, not necessarily reality, but getting away from all the serious crap that we deal with on a daily basis, whether that's, you know, all the negative stuff we see on the news, or just the fact that our boss is a shithead.
Right.
You know, so we want to read, and we want to close the book at the end of the night and have a smile on our face. And I'll tell you, having read quite a bit of Grimdark in my day, that's just not what you get. You can read it and appreciate it and be glad that you read it, but you don't close the book at the end of the day with a smile on your face.
No, and you know, maybe it's just a mark against me as a reader, but I just find it exhausting. It's just like, and then I these guys got killed, and then their sisters got raped, and then like some guy punched a dog, and then his grandma got fired out of a catapult. I'm like, all right, I get it.
Well, and so not to get too literary on you.
Get literary.
I almost feel like Grimdark is in a lot of ways not terribly dissimilar from some of the postmodernist literary work that we saw in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s, kind of in that period when you were getting folks like Don DeLillo and some of his stuff, and Martin Amis and some of his stuff, but these novels that were very much sort of focusing in on kind of the darker side of modern society. And they're sort of in a response to other fiction, right? Like that's the nature of postmodernism, is sort of responding to the moment. And I think Grimdark's kind of the same way, right? Like it's a clear response to 80s fantasy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Terry Brooks is why Grimdark exists.
Oh yeah, no, it's completely it's a total response to the overly sanitized, inauthentic fantasy of the 80s, where you know everyone, your whole life's destiny was based on what race you were born into, but like in a very peculiar way. Like if you were an orc, you're evil because you're an orc. If you're an elf, you're good because you're an elf. Magic saved everything. There was always a prophecy. The prophecy sort of had this connotation of a kind and loving God. Like, if only you can do this, then everything will turn out okay. But I think Grimdark has kind of gone in a complete circle, and it's, like, almost just as ridiculous now.
One of the limiting factors of Grimdark, and I think one of the limiting factors of science fiction and fantasy in general at times, is that it becomes inward-looking to a degree that we're no longer speaking outward, we're just speaking inward. And it doesn't make it any less good. In fact, sometimes I think that inward-looking nature can make a piece of fiction better.
Right.
For an inside reader. But we end up going into this loop mode where we're not reaching outside of our comfort zone for something bigger and something broader. Self-limiting to some degree.
I mean,
there's a place for both, obviously.
Yeah, there's a place for both. I just think I'm in the latter camp. It's like, all right, you know, I kind of had my fill of Grimdark. I get it. You know, the world's kind of a shitty place, and people are often bastards. I don't want another 200 pages rehashing that.
I do think it's fascinating, though, that Grimdark began with Warhammer.
Yeah.
Tie-in fiction.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny, though, if you think about it, a lot of people will point to a piece of tie-in fiction as being one of the really big impetuses between the 1980s push, too, and that's sort of like the Dragonlance novels.
God.
Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. It's funny, though, that tie-in fiction is really can often be sort of a test ground for this stuff before it goes into original work.
That makes sense, though, doesn't it? It's like it's not as big a risk if it fails, because if it fails, they're still going to go back to Dungeons and Dragons or Warhammer.
But, yeah, and I think a lot of it, too, is the people that are creating the original intellectual property grew up getting into this stuff through tie-in fiction, because tie-in fiction is that access drug a lot of times, right?
Yeah. I wrote a big blog post about Drizzt Do'Urden.
Is he significant to you?
Yeah, because you know I was a 14-year-old boy, and I'm not saying once.
What would you classify yourself as now?
like a 29-year-old boy.
Oh, you've come a long way.
I've come a while. But I mean, how could Driz not appeal to me then? He was designed for me. It's like he's badass. He has two swords and his noble animal companion. But everyone he kills is evil, so they deserve it. So there's no moral responsibility. And he's too virtuous to get laid, so that's why he doesn't get laid.
Right. Just like me. Not because he's socially awkward or
not because he's socially or unattractive. No, it's just no one understands him.
Right.
It's everyone else's fault. You know, like that's still the appeal for a lot of people in a lot of things. And I think that's probably one of the appeals of Grimdark as well, is just that this idea that, you know, oh, the world's shitty anyway, so, you know, it's not my fault. They were going to die anyways.
Well, I think culpability is one of those things that's always interesting in fiction. I mean, we always seem, and not just science fiction and fantasy, I think it's much broader than that, that we look for that echo of absolving ourselves from guilt and from responsibility for our own feelings.
Yeah, and that's a big part of my books. They have a lot of angst in them. They have a lot of people self-loathing themselves. But I kind of feel like the absolution that comes from Grimdark sort of ends with who's dead. Like, might makes right. And, you know, one of the things why I say Joe is not Grimdark is because nothing ever really got solved with violence, which is a point I think a lot of people miss when reading Joe Abercrombie, is just nothing is easy for his characters, and they often resort to violence out of a frustration of not being able to fix it themselves. And then at the end, it doesn't work. Like at the end of Best Served Cold, spoilers, fellows. At the end of Best Served Cold, you know, Shivers was kind of more fucked up than ever. And, you know, he didn't, you know, nothing was solved.
In my reread of The Blade itself, I'm just nearing the end of that book, and there's a scene where Major West beats his sister for the first time.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's the classic case of this feeling of impotence, not sexual impotence, but just impotence with the situation that turns him to this violence. And he solves nothing by it. In fact, he makes his problems worse. And I actually think, you're absolutely right. I think it's pervasive throughout the series. In fact, I've actually been struck by how little violence there actually, how little, plot relevant violence there is in the first book.
Yeah.
There is violence, but it's almost like side. They don't resolve anything with it.
Yeah. I mean, but the plot relevant violence is always the violence that turns people back. Like, nearly every one of his characters hits a point where they could opt to just say, whoa, what's going on? And stop. But they always fall back into the same trick of killing people and that solving nothing, because being that bigger person is just too hard. And
there's that, I think that nature of failure of any of his characters to really realize that self-improvement is often why he's considered grimdark, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that goes to this idea of nihilism. Like, it's always futile. It's always hopeless. Nothing means anything. But I think the real beauty of Joe's writing is in the failure. Like, the idea, like, oh, this could have been so beautiful, but now we have just pieces of a beautiful thing lying shattered on the ground.
Well, and I think I've heard you say before in one of our many conversations that you believe that what makes Joe not grimdark is that his characters are making a legitimate effort to be better.
Yes,
they just fail.
They fight against the darkness. They're just not very good at it. And that's why I always groan, because Joe Abercrombie got a lot of shit for his sex scenes, which is just ridiculous, because those sex scenes...
Squelch.
she gripped the root of his cock. Like, there's a lot of onomatopoeia there.
There's a great deal of onomatopoeia. In fact, onomatopoeia, he may be a master of onomatopoeia.
He was not elegant. He did not choose a lot of sexy words. He might just not have had Roger's sexy thesaurus on hand.
Elizabeth Baer wrote a sex scene that I've praised in Range of Ghosts, and she compared women... she compared the flanks of a horse during sex. Like, she used that as like a metaphor, and Joe didn't do that.
I mean, there's peculiar fantasy authors can be counted on to make some very strange discussions about sex, like in The Wise Man's Fear, where Quoth compares women to like eloquent symphonies and jaunty little jigs. It was a little strange, but the point is, in Joe Abercrombie's sex scenes, it was two broken people trying their best to figure out how to be human again, and that's what made them just work completely. And I think so many people don't get that. They're like, I think a lot of people want Joe to be grimdark, but I don't think he is. I think a lot of people want to be like, oh, what's all this nasty sex getting in the way of my violence.
And I think that just speaks to the fact that a lot of readers aren't going to take the time to go deeper into what Abercrombie's doing. And I think having gone through this reread process, I've read the First Law trilogy a couple of times prior to this, and now I'm reading it again at a very slow pace. I mean, I read about a chapter and a half a week. I've been so much more impressed this time through with what he's doing, and it's because I'm taking the time to really pay attention to it. And because you can read a book and just get lost in the story and not pay attention to any of this stuff. I mean, there's things I've noticed this time through that I just never noticed before. I think that's a big part of it. And I also think in genre reading, and not just science fiction and fantasy, when I say genre, I mean all the genres, mystery, suspense, thriller, all of that stuff, we read them primarily for plot. I mean, that's what we do. And when you read them at the pace that you read them at when you're reading for plot, you just miss the details.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a shame, because there's a lot going on in these books that I think people need to see more of.
Since you're on the podcast, I'll say something nice about you, since we said so many nice things about other people. In your new book, which I have read, there is a sex scene not terribly dissimilar from that. I mean, there's not nearly as much onomatopoeia, thank God.
There's no squelching.
There's no squelching, but it's a scene between two people that are pretty estranged from other people. I mean, they don't really have a lot of connections to other people, and they try to find a connection to each other, and I think it's a very effective scene.
Yeah, I was proud of that.
And generally, I think you do a really good job. I mean, I think a lot of what you do is thoughtful. You clearly put a lot of thought into your characters' relationships. Well, in fact, I would say that's the primary purpose of your fiction, right? Is the relationships between your characters.
Yeah. As I get older, I kind of don't care as much about, I mean, I used to be hugely action heavy, but I just really want to see how broken people try not to be broken, and I think that's very interesting. I can see why that's not everyone's bag.
Well, I think more and more, I think it is true as you get older, and I think you can even see, to use another writer we've already talked about, Brent Weeks, like if you read all of Brent Weeks' books, starting with his first book to his most recent book, I mean, there's a drastic shift in even how he plots and deals with things. I mean, he's become much more character driven and much less, like all of his daggers don't find the jugular these days.
Yeah. That was jugular is such a nice word.
It is. Can you throttle a jugular, or?
I don't think so. I think like a jugular is something that you have to perforate or
puncture or
slice. I don't think you can throttle it.
If I touch my neck, where is the jugular? Is it the neck itself, or is it like the esophagus and everything around the esophagus?
I always assumed it was like that big vein in your neck when you tense.
Right. Are you touching yours now? Because I'm touching mine.
I am touching mine.
I'm glad that won't be taken out of context.
Yeah, no, that won't be taken. Here you're on Rocket Talk. Like, speaking of Dragonlance, tying this whole thing back in, they had this rule where, you know, they wouldn't write sex scenes. They would just end with someone removing their boots. That was the cue that someone was about to knock said boots.
So by removing the boots, they were knocking the boots?
Yeah, they were knocking the boots, like, as one of them mounted the other one.
You're saying Gold Moon would de-boot Riverwind before they...
God! That's how you knew they were savages, because they were the only people in Dragonlance whose names did not do what... were not an iteration of what they did. That was what was great about Dragonlance, is your name told everyone what you did.
Really? Like, I don't know about that.
I'm Tannis, half-elven.
Okay.
Sturm Brightblade. I'm a paladin. Flint Fireforge. I make weapons because I'm a dwarf.
Castlehoff Burfoot?
Castlehoff Burfoot. I'm an asshole. I'm a burr in your foot.
And then Raistlin Majeer.
Raistlin Majeer and his brother Caramon, his name pretty much screams, I'm extraneous.
He really was.
As my name, I am here to make my brother look good.
Right, yeah.
Kitiara Uthmathar, she's got three names. She must be pretty bad news.
I always get your character, Kataria.
Yeah.
Used with Kitiara.
They both are pretty aggressive women.
They are. And they are spelled similarly.
They both have K's, T's, and vowels.
And R's.
There's like one R each.
I'm a little worried for everybody listening to this. I know how to spell your characters' names better than you do.
No, you don't. I was testing you. To see what you knew about ours. People listening to this are clearly chiming in to hear my witty thoughts on rockets.
Which also has an R.
Which has an R. And yeah, this went downhill, man.
This one got away from us.
This one did not end well.
Grimdark.
Grimdark has two R's. Which is also in George R.R., which also has a G.
Whoa. So
there you have it.
The Sifwa Bulletin came out today.
Sifwa Bulletin. God, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we can talk about that a little bit.
This was great. Like, you know, I'll be totally honest. I will be completely 100% honest. I love watching people melt down most of the time. I can't help it. I collect awkward situations.
And we've discussed this. I mean, who is currently wearing the crown for meltdowns?
Oh.
I would say Hugh Howey.
Hugh Howey.
Still wearing the crown.
Hugh Howey. That was an amazing meltdown.
It was.
Wow. You know, lest we seem like we are picking on poor Hugh Howey, and he is crying into his bags of money right now.
Buckets.
His buckets of money before he goes for a dip in his money bin. He did make right. He came out, he apologized, he acknowledged what he was doing, and, you know, he saw why what he said was pretty messed up. You know, we should give him credit for that.
Yeah, yeah, it took him a while to get there, but yeah, he righted the ship.
Yeah, you know, we don't want to act like we are reveling in his misery.
Not at all.
Not at all. But, you know, it was
purely an academic discussion of the
Academic discussion. That, I mean, you know, a cautionary tale. That was one hell of a meltdown.
It's like discussing the power levels of the Avengers. It's not it's not like Quicksilver is really just a nothing.
I mean, yes.
You know, we don't mean to belittle him by making him the weakest of the Avengers. It's just a fact.
Yes.
It's academic discussion.
It's academic and. You know, he came out all right. As you know, a lot of people who have meltdowns come out all right. They usually have happy endings, but my goodness, they are interesting to watch.
Yes.
As they go down. You know, the Sifwa Bulletin business was wow.
dragging ourselves kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
Which is hard. Which is hard. It's just so difficult to be in a world where you can't just call people
horrible names.
Horrible names.
And expect to get off on it. Or ooh, that was the wrong
get off on it. Ooh, you're on Rocket Talk.
Yeah.
I mean part of the reason these meltdowns were so entertaining was that there was this wildly disproportionate response from the people who were making the original comments, because it was like, boy, she looked great in a bathing suit. You know, this was like one of the original topics of scandal where two dudes were talking about editors and commenting on their looks, and other readers and authors of CIFWA stepped in and said, how is that relevant to her editing? You know, I agree with them. It's like, you know, if you're talking about editors, let's talk about editing here, fellas. But, you know, and then they just, where the entertainment value came is they just went berserk.
Like, how dare you question my right to discuss how somebody looks in a bathing suit?
Yeah, it's like,
and she should be flattered.
She should be flattered, and god damn it, this youth generation stealing my rights. I think at the moment you use the word fascist in a discussion like that, you have lost. It's like a good Godwin's law. It's like the conversation is over at that point.
Yeah, it's just a word we shouldn't use very often, if ever.
No, I mean you talk about bathing suits when you're talking about bathing suits, or talking about people who look good in bathing suits, but not when you're talking about editing in a professional bulletin.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. I'm still stuck on this fascist thing.
Well, yeah, I mean,
because it reminded me of my youth. Well, I'll tell you why. My mother, I grew up in a split political household. My mother would often refer to any elected Republican as a fascist.
Whether she was
wrong or not is another question, but...
Yeah, I mean, at that point, it's done.
Exactly.
We can't discuss this anymore because this is clearly outrageous.
You've just compared somebody to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, everyone's familiar with Godwin's Law. Like, the minute you invoke in an argumentative sense, the minute you invoke a comparison to Nazis, the conversation is over. Because no matter what you're arguing, they are not like Nazis. Whatever you're saying.
When did Godwin establish this law?
It came about on some internet forum. I'm sure it's out on Wikipedia somewhere. But basically, and you know, I'm sure I'm gonna get someone jumping on me saying I'm quoting Godwin's law. But basically, the idea is that once someone says invokes Nazis as a metaphor or a comparison, the conversation is over. It's like we can't go any further. It's like, all right, we are done. It's basically like a conversational suicide pact, I think.
I'm actually reading about Godwin's Law on Wikipedia right now, and apparently Godwin is closely associated with memetics.
Okay.
Which is the study of memes.
Oh. All right, well.
Which I just, that's just a random, but I enjoy memes, so that's why.
Yeah, well, we're getting off.
Fine, we went off topic, Sam. I'm sorry.
Well, don't take that passive-aggressive voice with me. It's because I interrupted your memes. Because you wanted to bring up Doge.
I think that was all about backdooring Doge.
You wanted to bring in Doge and much derail.
Much derail. Very, very off topic.
Very off topic. Wow. God, now Brent Weeks is not going to listen to this.
He has a real aversion to the Doge, doesn't he?
He does not like Doge, which, you know... Fair enough.
Now, point out, Mike Cole didn't like Doge either until you bought Mike Cole a Doge shirt.
Well, this was all my attempt to turn Mike into the Shiba Inu guy. Because it really bugs me when people send me pug pictures. I have a pug. His name is Otis, and he's awesome. And I post a lot of pictures of him.
A lot.
A lot, because I think he's awesome and he's funny looking and he does strange things. But, you know, people seem to think this means I am, like, one of those old ladies who has, like, ceramic pugs. And my welcome mat says, beware of pugs.
Have fans sent you pugs?
Like, pug? Like, little...
Like, little porcelain pugs?
No, no.
Can I just say that if anybody listening to this podcast sends Sam a porcelain pug, I will send you something.
I will send you a bomb.
I will send... if a fan sends you a porcelain pug, I will send that fan a gift.
What? A doge? A porcelain doge?
Probably just some books.
With your face on it?
Probably just some books, but...
You are never going to get my address. You are never going to get my address. But, I mean, people assume that I'm like this a pug lady. I'm a crazy pug lady.
I would say, I think if somebody sends a pug with Sam Sykes' name on it to George R. R. Martin's movie theater, it will probably get to you.
No! Damn it! Soon you're going to alienate. I'm going to get a letter from George being like, what the fuck are all these pugs being sent to me?
Like a cease and desist.
A cease and depug. So anyways, I got tired of being like the only pug guy because people kept inundating me with pug memes. So I just started posting Shiba Inus to Mike's Twitter, and I started associating his name with Shiba Inus whenever possible in the hopes that people would start spamming him with Shiba Inu photos. Like, if I could convince the world that Mike Cole was really into Shiba Inus, then...
How'd that go?
It worked, obviously. He's very clearly into them, so...
Yeah, I'll just tell the listeners here that at Confusion, we most of us arrived late Thursday night. Sam presented Mike Cole with a, would you say gift bag? Was it a gift bag?
It was a bag in which there was a gift.
In which there was a gift. And in that gift was a Doge shirt. and you managed to get a Doge shirt that fit him perfectly.
It was amazing. It was like they were meant to be.
It is. It almost like you had snuck into Mike Cole's closet and,
yeah,
and found out his size.
I asked him on Twitter.
Or you could, that's probably the easier.
I was hoping that you would come up with something better. Like when we were talking and he went to stretch, like I just measured him real quick. Well, I guess he was yawning. Like, he'd be like, what'd you just do? Nothing.
What would you have measured him with?
Like, I don't know.
Do you keep a tape measure in your pocket?
Yeah, sometimes. Like in this case, Justin,
you had been prepared.
I was clearly waiting for him to yawn so I could measure him. So obviously I would have a tape measure on me.
Obvi.
This is why. Why aren't more people mad at you? You say things like obvi. So let's talk about Phoenix Comic Con. That's coming up.
Oh yeah, we should talk about Phoenix Comic Con. You are a guest of honor.
I don't believe we have guests of honor. We just have guests.
You are an invited guest.
Yes, they are all honored. Lee Whiteside puts together the writer's track, and he goes amazingly out of his way to accommodate everyone and make everyone feel really welcome, and that is why it is a hugely fun con that I advised everyone to go to, and now everyone is coming.
Now let's talk real quick about what a con like Phoenix Comic Con is in comparison to, say, the convention that we were at a few weeks ago, Confusion, one of which is a fan run con, and Phoenix Comic Con, which is a professional endeavor. So
a professional endeavor. You know, it's a Comic Con, so that is, it's bigger, and it has very mixed media. Like there's movie people and TV people and comic people and book people and game people all together. It's huge. It takes up the entire Phoenix. Well, I think most of the Phoenix Convention Center. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, one of the things that I think about Phoenix Comic Con is it's very new nerd. It's like for these geeks who are very like savvy about all types of media.
So would you call it Nerd Nouveau?
I would call it Nerd Nouveau. I like that. I like that word. And it's got a lot of new faces, and you know, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, there's everyone comes, so there's a lot of older fans too.
And you've got some big name authors coming this year, right? Patrick Rothfuss is going to be there.
Patrick Rothfuss, Jim Boucher.
in the Nouveau theme.
Jim Patrick Rothfuss.
Rothfuss.
Jim Boucher. Mike Qualley.
Is Kevin Hearn going to be there?
Yeah, Kevin Hearn is going to be there. Kevin Hearn is always there.
Charlene Harry.
Delilah S. Dawson. Dawson.
She seems very funny.
Delilah is extremely funny. Like, funny and, like, really, really nice, but in a weird way. Liana Renee Hebert is going to be there. Heber. And April Lynn Pike. A lot of YA authors, like the whole lineup is going to be there. Brian McLellan is not a female, but he'll be there.
I would very much like to come to Phoenix Comic Con. We will see what happens. It sounds like a great time.
It is going to be a great time.
And it's in the desert. I grew up in the desert, so I like the desert.
Yeah.
And it's in June?
June, yeah, the first weekend of June. We're having a punishment game.
I believe we call that a Batsu game.
Batsu, yeah. Batsu, which is Japanese for punishment. It's going to be 7 authors on a panel and me hosting.
I assume the panel is in scare quotes, clearly.
Yes, panel. It is a mockery of a panel, mm-hmm. A sham, if you will. And I will be trying hard to make them laugh. And if they laugh, they get punished.
So you're telling me this is reliant on how funny you are?
I'm a pretty funny guy.
Yeah.
Like, you have chuckled a few times here.
I have.
Mostly over stuff that we have had to cut, so the audience will not have heard you laughing at all, but and just
so
replace
who's
it.
So playing in this game? Do you know yet?
Yes, I do. I have planned it all out. Patrick Rothfuss.
Okay, so this is not a surprise to anybody, but Patrick Rothfuss sells a lot of books.
Yeah.
So are you concerned that by overly punishing him, you may be threatening your own career?
Yeah, but you know me. I'll go a long way for a joke.
career be damned.
Like, career be damned. Like, I'll be dying in poverty. You'll come to visit me and be like, was it worth it? And I'll be like, damn right. As I urinate into a coffee can and use it to water my fern. Patrick Rothfuss, Chuck Wendig, Mike Cole, Delilah Dawson, Leanna Renee Heber, April Lynn Pike, and John Scalzi.
Oh, goodness.
yeah, it's gonna be bad. Like, good, but, you know, in a bad way.
Yeah, I think you need to come up with a punishment that involves Chuck's beard in some way.
Like, if you get punished, you have to brussel with Chuck?
Yeah, or like somebody has to shave Chuck's beard for him.
Well, that beard is iconic. I can't just shave that without his consent.
Well, I think by agreeing to participate, he's implied consent.
We're in some shady ground there, so...
Are there going to be forms, waivers that they'll sign?
I just sent them an email. I said, if you want out, you can go out. I'm going to judge you, but you can go out. So, like, I'm hoping they will be too, like, embarrassed.
I'm stunned that you didn't auction off a seat in this Batsu game for World Builders.
We are actually going to try to do something where the more they get punished, the more I will. there will be donated. But I mean, I chose the people who get me and get my sense of humor and will not feel like I am picking on them.
Do you have sole discretion on the punishments?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to make it palatable.
Sure, like, are you pre-writing punishments, though, or are you coming up with them on the spot?
I mean, we only have the one punishment, which is drinking Kuding tea.
Oh, that's the only punishment.
That's the only punishment, but it is one hell of a punishment. Oh, my God.
Will it make you vomit?
No. No, you'll want to, but it won't.
Okay.
I mean, it tastes like fluoride.
I mean, the only fluoride I've ever had in my mouth tasted like bubblegum.
See, you were like, did you just never go to the dentist or what?
No, but like the dentist, I had fluoride that tasted like bubblegum.
Really? Are you sure you didn't just say you were going to the, you just said you were going to the dentist and then you chewed bubblegum instead?
I mean, yeah, it was like in a little tray that they put in your mouth? Or are you talking about the stuff that they like brush you with?
It's that nasty stuff that you have to rinse with.
I think we had very different dentist experiences.
Yeah, what the fuck, man? You're older than me, so it's like, how was this developed?
It's just like, it's just quite possible that your mom doesn't like you very much.
Did was that just not around in Arizona? Were we too poor, or what? Our backward society has resulted in.
It's probably something Jan Brewer did.
Jan Brewer. God, she vetoed that bill. Good for her.
Good for her.
Good for her, but that's not on topic. That's not junk.
It's just not at all.
Cut that.
Oh, cut it.
Cut it all. Cut everything.
All right. So now, let's go up with some awkward ending for this podcast.
All right. Well, I mean, the whole podcast has been pretty awkward.
I'm sure there's something in there that I could rearrange to be the ending.
Like, we have...
So you know what? Let's just do this.
Okay.
Sam Sykes, thank you so much for being with me on Rocket Talk tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on Rocket Talk.
You can find Sam on his website at www.samsykes.com or on Twitter at Sam Sykes Swears.
All one word.
All one word.
Or find me on Facebook as Sam Sykes, or just... You can't have my address to send pugs to.
But George R. R. Martin's movie theater will accept them.
No, he will not.
Cue music that will take us out.